From the Mountain Broadcast Center, this is Take 2. May Martinez. The city and county of Los Angeles are being called to the carpet on homelessness. U.S. Central District Judge David O'Carter wants local leaders to explain why, after months of promises, plans, and meetings, nothing substantial has been done for Skid Row's unhoused population. So he invited them to the downtown Women's Center to hear what they had to say. We'll find out all about it ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. Amy Martinez coming up.
I feel like Sparks like deserve to be Los Angeles rock royalty. And the only thing that's been holding them back is people think that they're not from California.
The band known as the biggest British band coming out of America is getting some newfound fame in a documentary that just debuted at Sundance. We're going to hear from the director, Edgar Wright, just ahead. But first, to a hearing on homelessness that just wrapped up in downtown Los Angeles. Frustrated over a seeming lack of progress on that front, U.S. District Judge David O'Carter called city and county officials to the downtown Women's Center today to discuss what is being done to house the more than 66,000 people living on the streets or in shelters across the county. Carter ordered the meeting Sunday night after witnessing the effects of last night's rainstorms on the unhoused living on Skid Row. Now, in his briefing, Judge Carter wrote, "It is the court's concern that despite 7 months of promises, conferences, plans, and meetings, nothing substantial has been done to remediate the appalling and dangerous conditions in Los Angeles' Skid Row for the homeless population." He then noted that more than 1,300 homeless persons died in the city and county of Los Angeles last year, a 32% increase over 2019. That hearing began at 10 a.m. this morning, and KPCC's Libby Denkman was there. It wasn't just the storm that set this meeting into motion. There's a lawsuit hanging over this as well. What's the background on this?
Yes, this is an ongoing case that Carter has been overseeing since last March. It's a lawsuit by a coalition of downtown business and homeowners, which they argue that the conditions on LA streets are simply inhumane, and they believe that tax money, especially from Triple H, the bond measure, and Measure H, the county level measures that taxpayers approved in order to fix the homelessness crisis. This group of plaintiffs argues that that money has been wasted or misspent. Now, last June, the city and county agreed to add 6,000 shelter beds, which was a compromise response to an order by Judge Carter last May that they needed to relocate up to 7,000 people who are living near freeway overpasses and on and off ramps. And now Judge Carter is following up on that compromise and saying it's simply not enough progress so far from what he's seeing, the conditions on the ground in LA County.
All right. So what did Judge Carter have to say today about how the city and county are handling things?
First, I just want to set the scene, A, because this was the most unusual federal hearing I have ever attended. This was a hearing held in a parking lot outside the downtown Women's Center, which provides permanent supportive housing for people who are women who are living on the street. Now, this was a tent that had been erected in order to bring people in from the street. And instead of people who were homeless, the people that were in this tent were luminaries from different parts of government across L.A. County. Carter was bringing them one by one up to his fold-out desk that he presided over the hearing from. And even at one point, there weren't enough chairs, and Carter got up himself to offer a chair to one of the advocates who was speaking. We had to rotate in and out because of COVID-19 restrictions, of course. And Carter said he was very concerned about both the women that he witnessed on the street on Friday when he tried to help people coming in from a rainstorm. He had showed photos of these women who were barely clothed, shivering in the rain, and he even compared this site to what one would see in images of the Holocaust. He also brought up over and over again issues of equity, how many more Black people are affected by homelessness and the city's responsibility to fix that. And Judge Carter also said he's looking at the landmark school desegregation ruling by the Supreme Court, Brown versus Board of Education, for guidance when it comes to finding an equitable solution to homelessness in LA County. And he really ultimately was returning again and again, A, to this idea of how can the court continue to trust the city of LA and the county to fix things when this problem just keeps getting worse, no matter what is ordered and what the county and city promise. And Carter says he's really exploring the limits of the court's power here.
And you wrote in your story on Elias, Libby, that he flat out told the city, I don't trust you.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the question that came up again and again is whether or not the court will impose a consent decree on the parties involved here. So that includes the plaintiffs, the business owners. The consent decree theoretically would involve activists and advocates for the homeless, the city and the county, and LASA, the joint powers entity that sort of is supposed to be working between the city and county to deal with homelessness. Now, this is something that LA City Councilman Mike Bonin argued in an op-ed yesterday that is needed. He asked the judge to impose a consent decree, saying that the responsibility for homelessness is just too diffuse and there are too many different jurisdictions that can't work together effectively enough. And he wants the court to step in and require regular check-ins, to have these court-mandated benchmarks to meet, and things that only a consent decree can really accomplish.
Now, lots of people showed up today from city council members such as Kevin DeLeon, whose district includes Skid Row, to a number of homeless advocates. Now, among the politicians who was there, what did officials have to say for themselves about the progress that they feel that they have made and about the threat of the consent decree?
Yeah, definitely. All the politicians who showed up today, except for Mike Bonin, said that they hoped that the city and county could avoid a consent decree. Now, you'll remember that the city had to enter into one when the LAPD Rampart scandal was going on. You know, things like toxic waste cleanup. These are really big and long-standing agreements and commitments that the city and county would have to make. And you can tell that elected officials would like to avoid that if at all possible. They want to keep as much power in the hands of the city and the county as they can. You know, Hilda Solis, the chairwoman of the LA County Board of Supervisors, came and talked about many supportive housing facilities that were being built in the county, some new innovative ways that they're building faster, getting these things up and running sooner. Catherine Barger was also in attendance. Dr. Jonathan Sharon, the head of the county's Department of Mental Health, was there. And De Leon really kind of took the lead in terms of speaking because it was in his council district. And he spoke about his frustration already, just, you know, a month and a half on the job with the lack of progress.
Now, those are the people that were there. One notable person was not there today, and that was Mayor Eric Garcetti. And I understand that caused some rumbles under the tent. So tell us more about that.
It did. The mayor said yesterday he wasn't going to be there, but that didn't stop Judge Carter from sort of dramatically announcing the mayor's name and then pausing and then asking the staff eventually to approach the bench in the mayor's place just to sort of make that point. And the judge grilled the mayor's staff on details and brought up this pledge that Garcetti announced yesterday that he was going to ramp up housing people in hotel and motel rooms through Project Room Key. And that's thanks to the commitment by the Biden administration that the administration says it will reimburse temporary living facilities at 100% through FEMA reimbursement, so an emergency management reimbursement process. Now, the judge, this is the point at which he said, I believe you, but I don't trust you, to the mayor's staff. The judge knows that, you know, Project Room Key had a promise of housing 15,000 people, but at its peak only had 4,000 people in beds in September. And since then, it's been taking rooms offline. So it's hard to see the way forward and how that's going to really solve what's going on here.
I'm just going to throw this out there. Judge Carter asked for this meeting Sunday, for this meeting today on February 4th. Today happens to be Eric Garcetti's 50th birthday. So I'm just going to leave it there and move on. So, Libby, at the end of the day, where do we stand on this? I mean, what are the next steps that need to happen to avoid a consent decree?
Yeah, the judge kind of didn't commit to anything here. He said that he has to keep looking for answers. He has to gather more information, probably hold more hearings. You could tell the elected leaders were very committed to trying to convince him that it was not necessary. You know, the images that he showed of women in Skid Row, particularly women he said were vulnerable on the streets and really suffering in this rainstorm, and the red tape he said that he encountered and council member De Leon and some activists encountered when they were trying to get these women off the street and into either some 120 beds or so that were supposedly available through LASA. Those beds fell through. They weren't able to get the women housed on site at this parking lot at the Downtown Women's Center in temporary tents. And you could just tell the frustration that he had with the lack of accountability and action from all different jurisdictions, city and county and nonprofits, when he was there on the ground trying to help these women and, you know, going out and bringing them blankets and coats. But it just wasn't enough, and so the judge will have to decide going forward what the city and county will have to do.
All right, we'll keep track of this. That's KPCC's Libby Denkman. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, let's turn now to Amy Turk, CEO of Downtown Women's Center, where Judge Carter's hearing took place today. Amy, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So how did your center come to be the site of today's hearing?
Our involvement in today's hearing is that Judge Carter decided that Downtown Women's Center would be the host of the meeting. He had the meeting held in what we normally use as our parking lot.
Okay, so that was his decision to do this?
Yes.
Okay. Now, a big trigger for calling this meeting seems to be the rain that happened last week on Friday. Judge Carter cited how that was an example of how dangerous it is for those living outside right now. You were there, as was Councilman Kevin De Leon. Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened on Friday?
Yeah, on Friday, Judge Carter came to the Downtown Women's Center. We're a social service that exclusively works with ending homelessness for women. And, you know, we do that through housing and healthcare, employment, and our advocacy work. The impetus seemed related to the rain. And he, with some partners, installed two tents on the parking lot that we normally use.
Oh, okay. So when that happened, were you okay with having your parking lot or having this parking lot be used in that way?
You know, we have big plans for our parking lot. We've been working with our council member, De Leon, to build permanent supportive housing on what is currently a city-owned parcel of land. And as we were making plans for that and well underway in pre-development, we had been talking about what could we do with this land in the meantime before we break ground. And so we had some exploratory conversations, and on Friday, an opportunity just landed on Downtown Women's Center's door with Judge Carter coming in and installing the tents.
I asked that because today, Councilman De Leon called in City Health Commissioner Susie Shannon, who described what appears like a reluctance on your part on Friday to open doors to people she described as huddled in the parking lots. I'm wondering what your response to that description is.
Yeah, I spoke after her comments. You know, though we did not know that Judge Carter was coming, we are happy to set up what we're going to call the Women's Village to, you know, create a little more safety from literally living on the streets of Skid Row for a number of women. Though the judge was very quick at installing the tents with incredible speed, there wasn't incredible speed behind providing a contract for services or a fire permit or public health permit. So since Friday, those are in the works. Our council member put a motion through yesterday for a contract for services with Downtown Women's Center. And, you know, once we get everything in order, we're moving quite quickly and we intend to support the women in that way.
So it's sounding to me like, Amy, that what happened on Friday, maybe there was a lack of communication between all parties. It seems like it might have caught you guys off guard and that maybe Judge Carter moved quicker than anybody thought he would on this.
Yeah, everyone maintained that I met on Friday that they didn't know until they got a call from Judge Carter. He now has my cell phone, so maybe he'll call me next time. But I was the last to learn.
Okay. Was there any tension? Because, I mean, I can imagine. I mean, you're down there. All of a sudden, a judge comes. There's a councilman there. And this is happening. And I'm wondering if there was any tension on how things would be handled that night, considering that rain was coming down and it was a bit of an emergency situation.
Sure. You know, I think at the heart of all this, everyone wants to do more. Everyone wants to do as much as possible to address homelessness. And, you know, that everyone was sort of brought in unexpectedly, there was a bit of confusion. Though I would say by today at the hearing, same parties were here at the hearing, and the conversations are much more about alignment and partnership. And like I said, we're ready to provide the services.
Talking to Amy Turk, CEO of Downtown Women's Center. I know your organization, Amy, focuses on long-term solutions, such as permanent housing as opposed to temporary shelters. But I'm wondering, considering how much of an emergency situation the overall homelessness issue is in LA County, is there a tension between prioritizing these very different issues that have very different solutions, long-term as opposed to short-term?
Yeah, that's the tension that I'm seeing in this lawsuit and that I heard during the hearing today. You know, everyone's perfectly clear that we need to do something now and we need to do it urgently. But what I've seen resulting from the lawsuit is that we're really focused on basic and rudimentary shelter when we really should be focused on the long-term solutions. There were a number of people who spoke at the hearing today that were very concerned about that too, and we're very focused on permanent housing solutions.
So for an organization like yours that, as I mentioned, focuses on longer term solutions, does doing anything in the short term kind of split your focus and split your resources in a way?
Sure. I mean, we're still working with a finite number of resources. What I would recommend that we really focus on right now for short term, we've been calling out for a FEMA-like response to homelessness, and we finally got one. And, you know, if we focus more on Project Roomkey, the initiative utilizing vacant hotels, you know, that's a real humane way to shelter people, especially when we're in the middle of a pandemic where having your own room and bathroom is a part of, you know, keeping public health standards. And now that the Biden administration has made the promise of 100% reimbursement, I think that's where we should put our city and our county time for immediate responses while we're seeing through the promise of building supportive units through Proposition HHH and now turning our eye towards building permanent solutions through Project Home Key.
How will that right off the bat help your site, Downtown Women's Center, having that FEMA money come in at 100%?
Sure. You know, we operated one of the hotel rooms through Project Roomkey. We stood up a program with collaboration with the county and the city in 24 hours. We moved 60 women in, over the course of a day. The hotel was decommissioned. Those women have moved into permanent housing or Project Roomkeys that have remained open while we are finding them permanent housing. So we know that we can do it. We did it within 24 hours this last time. We'd be happy to expand again in that way.
Amy, considering that this whole meeting today, this hearing today, was Judge Carter, in effect, calling the city and the county on the carpet on this, wondering for you, your organization, what challenges have you had in addressing homelessness with the city and the county? What kind of grade would you give the city and county in handling this so far?
You know, I think that everyone is very well-intentioned, and we have a lot of plans in place. I think what causes some confusion is when those plans get suddenly changed, which this lawsuit has done. For example, we were all the most coordinated I've ever seen when we stood up the Project Roomkey initiative between city, county, and community-based organizations, well on a path to prioritizing those individuals to permanent housing. But then the lawsuit shifted our focus to then housing 6,000 people living under freeways and overpasses into the same amount of finite resources. And so that, you know, that took us off a path and it kind of confuses the system. We think that if you stay on a path and a plan that we can see better results.
One last thing, Amy, really quick. Hanging over all of this is the threat of a consent decree. Given the gravity of the situation and the slowness in addressing it, is that necessary, you think?
You know, I don't know. I heard the politicians today saying otherwise, other than Councilmember Bonin. I think if we continue on a lawsuit path, we'll just be in a lawsuit after lawsuit. A settlement might just leave us with, you know, X amount of shelter beds and not really a solution. You know, it would, in my opinion, be nice if the LA Homeless Services Authority had actual authority so that we could stay on the plan that they have strategically established, but usually gets altered by multiple city council motions or other decision makers deciding for them.
That's Amy Turk, CEO of the Downtown Women's Center. More Take Two coming up. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. We've talked a lot on this show about the slow and confusing COVID-19 vaccine rollout. I mean, virtually everyone is trying to get vaccinated or their vulnerable family members, and they've all dealt with the ever-changing eligibility rules and a glitchy online sign-up system, not to mention confusing messaging. Unfortunately, these systemic flaws are impacting those communities who've gotten sick and are dying at higher rates of COVID-19 than others, and that's Black and Latinos. As of January 23rd, only 5% of those vaccinated in LA County so far were Black. But joining us now is one doctor who has had success in addressing vaccine equity in South LA. Dr. Jerry Abraham works as director of vaccine programs at Kedron Health. Doctor, before we get to your solutions, tell us what it was like when your clinic was first trying to get its own vaccine doses.
We had not been contacted about vaccines yet, and we had nurses and patients with COVID, and we were wondering what is going on, because by that point, multi-county state entities had already received Pfizer, and I'd been watching the situation closely. And so next thing you know, we started asking questions. We got to the county Department of Public Health, and they were like, oh, we thought, you know, you were on someone else's list. You were a priority over there. They kind of just forgot about our little Black psychiatric hospital in South LA. And that's kind of how this whole thing started. Was Christmas Eve Eve, we really got connected with the Department of Public Health. And by New Year's Eve Eve, we had our first 50 doses into the arms of our staff.
So, doctor, it sounds like, you know, in addition to all the other problems that we've heard of, lack of doses, lack of workers, that clunky sign-up system, you almost had to, like, just jump up and raise your hand to make sure that you were not overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of what historically Black institutions, you know, have had to do for decades. We've had to kind of go and knock, and if not, bang down the door. And that's literally what we did. We drove one day in a van to the Department of Public Health, and we weren't going to leave until we had vaccines for my nurses and all the healthcare workers that work at Kedron. It's like flying a plane, you know, when there's an emergency. We had to put on our oxygen mask first, and I knew that was number one. But then we were going to make sure that we were going to help all of our neighbors, and that's what we're doing now.
So take us back then to December, when the vaccine doses were starting to get distributed from the state or the county. What did you need at the time, and what were you getting at your health center at the start?
The governor's office and the state had a challenge of allocating already an extremely limited supply throughout California. And what was allocated to LA just truly was not enough, was not sufficient, honestly wasn't fair or just. And then on top of that, within the county, how do you equitably distribute that to the millions of people that are down here that need it? There are hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in South LA. So how do you get them vaccines? And we didn't even have hundreds of thousands of doses then. So in those earliest days, we literally were driving up there asking for 50 doses. And then it was like 100 doses. And it literally reminds me of feeding of the multitude. You've got two loaves and five fishes. churches or whatever, and you're just praying somehow all 5,000 people will get vaccinated. So from that first day of 50 to the next day of 150 to that first 1,000 that we hit to now over 20,000 vaccinated, it's just been a tremendous rollout. And that just goes to show you, with ingenuity, with know-how, with technical experience, with real grit and brute effort and hard work, we were committed to getting this vaccine out from Kedron, and we did. And now we're an entity. We're now a resource in the community and for the county. They now know where to send expiring doses from skilled nursing facilities and other healthcare facilities.
Oh, they send them to you. They that's where they're going?
They redirect them to Kedron. And then, so actually it's a very complicated thing, but as soon as those very first doses from pre-Christmas, they're now expiring as of last week, and people didn't know what to do. And people are afraid to admit, I've got expiring doses in my fridge or freezer. And unfortunately, in those earliest days, thousands of doses were being discarded and wasted. And when we caught wind of that, we refused to let any drop go to waste at Kedron. So we literally, just like I got in a van and went to the Department of Public Health, we got in a van and we drove to every nursing home that had expiring doses. We put them in our van, we brought them here, and we said we were going to stay open as long as we have to make sure that every expiring dose went into anyone's arms who were outside. Of course, the priorities being first and foremost, all healthcare workers, then all seniors over 65, and then we prioritized the geographic zip codes that we're from here in South LA.
What were the workarounds that you're using to address barriers to a vaccination?
You know, I know everybody is well-intentioned and everybody means the best, and we're all trying to come together to get everyone vaccinated so that we can get ahead and actually squash COVID-19, period. And we're doing it for all the right reasons, but I just refuse to prioritize data over people. And that's been a mantra here at Kedron. It is people first. And so to do people first and to do it right, we weren't going to let a broken appointment system get in the way. We weren't going to allow a grandma and grandpa who may not have a cell phone or do not have email addresses or may not even have internet. How were they supposed to access CalVax and get an appointment? And instead, what we saw in those earliest days are digital hipsters, tech natives who were able to skip the line. You click some buttons and next thing you know, the wealthiest and perhaps those without a need were able to get appointments. So we knew that that system was not fair and right. And I know we're working together with the county and the state to continue to improve the online appointment system. Another workaround is we're one of the few sites where we are walk-up. Most of our patients and our neighbors here don't have vehicles. They take buses, public transportation, they walk, they bicycle. We wanted to create a place, a safe haven where they could walk up and receive a vaccine if they were eligible, healthcare workers, seniors over 65, or people that were prioritized from geographic zip codes where there were hotbeds of COVID. So that was another workaround. To help grandma and grandpa, those with vision impairments, hearing impairments, mobility limitations, we made sure that we created a paper process. So they themselves were not banging their heads against a computer or a smartphone, which they don't even have. We actually have now volunteers who help them fill out the forms. Then we have volunteers who do the data entry. Then we have volunteers who are at night entering to the reporting systems what we did that day. That way, the actual user, the client, the front-facing, the patient, the grandma, the undocumented worker are not fighting the system, the digital system. They're actually coming here and getting a vaccine.
Talking to Dr. Jerry Abraham of Kedron Community Health Center. Doctor, there's this notion that the Black and Latino community is less likely to trust the safety and efficacy of the COVID vaccine. But you push back against that. Do you think that's true?
So when we talk about vaccine hesitancy, particularly in the Black community, what is most frustrating, and as you may have heard me say, what vaccine? We weren't even offered a vaccine. So misinterpreting lack of access for hesitancy was, to me, very offensive, because the Black and brown healthcare workers that came here with their arms, their sleeves rolled up, and they were ready for a vaccination. We have seen less than 3% vaccine hesitancy amongst our Black and brown healthcare workers. I have lines of Black and brown grandmas and grandpas ready to get this vaccine. I think the first and foremost critical issue was there weren't enough vaccines. there weren't enough hands to deliver them, and there weren't enough resources and funding to do all this work critically. But what we see is that when you make it available, when we spend and take the time to answer people's questions, to educate, to engage, they will proudly accept a vaccine that is this life-saving, essential medicine. And so that has been our mantra and our story, is that the patient first. Let's figure out what the issues are. And those that are eligible and those that have no real contraindications should get it. And when we take that approach, we see that that hesitancy really goes away. It doesn't change the fact that there are remaining questions. We are watching the science closely. These are novel scientific technologies. And we need to be honest and straightforward with the public and the messaging. And I think that confuses people, what they hear and see on TV, on the radio, on the internet. So they are getting mixed messages. So we need to take the time, be patient, answer their questions. And if we do that, we won't see the hesitancy that we see. And I think one of the key ways to approach that is the strategic partnerships we have with the county government, with the politicians' offices, with community benefits and community engagement organizations and faith leaders and churches. And once they're all involved, they help us with that engagement and that education piece so we can truly focus on getting all those vaccines into people's arms.
Doctor, overall, what are the solutions to this issue of getting more people in vulnerable communities of color vaccinated? What other clinics need to be supported in doing some of this work?
Everybody needs a vaccine when they're eligible and based on risk and priorities, right? So I think the way that we're kind of pushing up against some of the racial justice issues outside of our gates constantly, it's not because we're turning away people because they're rich or because they're white. It's just that right now we have to get the healthcare workers in, the seniors in, people from these areas. But the real solution will lie in us continuing to get into the community. I describe them as our ice cream trucks. We're building a fleet of mobile units that will then go to the churches, to the community centers. We will do the education, the engagement. It will culminate in a vaccination event. We need to be able to go to the homes of homebound seniors that don't have the luxury of being transported to a point of distribution. So there's a lot of these challenges that I think in the next few weeks, with the right amount of vaccine, with enough hands to actually administer it, and with enough resources, we really can roll out this vaccine literally to grandma's house, get her vaccinated, go to church, get a church vaccinated, go to a school, go to a library. And I think that day by day, until everyone is vaccinated and we've achieved 70% plus herd immunity, that is how we will end this pandemic here in Los Angeles County.
That's Dr. Jerry Abraham of Kedron Community Health Center. Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You know, we've known for a long time how difficult it is for veterans to get back in the flow when their tours of duty are over. A lot of them want to do stuff, but don't know how. And this time around, the pandemic has really made it extra difficult. Find out how when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Several states run programs designed to encourage entrepreneurship among veterans who recently left the armed forces. But the pandemic has made it especially difficult for vets who are trying to start a business. Bradley George has this report for the American Homefront Project.
Army veteran Natasha DeLintz served two tours in Iraq. While she was deployed, a crisis was unfolding at home.
Towards the end of my military career, my mom had gotten sick. And so that kind of, I guess, if you will, opened the gateway and exposed me to healthcare.
When she left the Army in 2012, DeLintz had to move her mother into a nursing home. She also decided to pursue healthcare as a career, first as a nursing assistant and then as a healthcare administrator. She says the experience of watching her mother decline and die in a nursing home was traumatic. She wasn't aware there were other options, like a group home.
And so I wanted to start my own company, not only to provide those kind of services, but to also educate, if you will, the community on their options.
Delenz had no experience setting up a business, so she turned to Rosie Lee. She's founder of Action Zone, a nonprofit in Tampa that guides veterans and their spouses through the steps of entrepreneurship.
We do one-on-one consultations. We have mentor and subject matter expert referrals. And we just nurture them from the time they have that idea to when they launch and beyond so that they can grow a viable and sustainable business.
Participants get up to 14 weeks of training on the ins and outs of running a business, hiring, payroll, marketing. Natasha DeLintz says by the end of the course, she crafted a plan for her group home. In early 2020, she was ready to open, and then came the pandemic. Her new business has been in a holding pattern ever since.
Each month that goes by, there's a loss in revenue because it's five empty beds that I have in my home right now that I have not been able to fill over the past year.
For now, DeLintz continues working her day job as a program administrator for the Florida Department of Veterans Affairs. She says she's tried to make the most of the past year, connecting with other home health providers so she can get a running start once the pandemic is under control.
They send referrals. They discuss maybe other opportunities in terms of, you know, in the future, if your home is full and I have an open bed, maybe we can network that way.
Rosie Lee says Action Zone has pivoted to offering training through Zoom and Facebook Live. She says vets learn how to adapt to difficult situations in the military, a necessary skill during pandemic lockdowns and economic uncertainty.
They have this culture, which is extremely entrepreneurial because they're very collaborative. They recognize opportunity. They recognize challenges as opportunity, and they find a way to fix that.
According to a survey from Syracuse University's Institute for Veterans and Military Affairs, 65% of vet entrepreneurs say their military experience prepared them for business challenges brought on by the pandemic. Syracuse researcher Rosie Vasquez-Mari says most vet-owned companies have weathered the pandemic economy fairly well.
I think overall, with the data that we've collected, most of people indicated that they are prepared. They won't close tomorrow, if you will. I think a good majority said they could probably be in this uncertainty for about a year timeframe.
During the campaign, President Biden promised help for veterans transitioning to civilian life, including an expansion of private sector training for post-military careers and a new program to promote entrepreneurship among military spouses. I'm Bradley George in Tampa.
All right, coming up, a couple of brothers from L.A. who had to leave the country to make it big and then come back. I'm going to get some more music coming up on Take Two. That's when Take Two continues, about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and also on KPCC.org. I'm Ian Martinez. All right. Have you ever heard of the band Sparks? I gotta keep reading. I was doing the Carlton while I was listening to that. That's Cool Places by Sparks with Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's. Now, it's the only song of theirs that I know, but in more than 50 years of making music, they've released like 250 songs. The story of Sparks, who are two brothers from L.A. named Ron and Russell Male, is told in a new documentary.
They really tiptoe through the tulips between beauty and revulsion.
What's going on? Oh my God.
It's insane, but it's fantastic.
They would make really good Muppets.
You have this snaky lead singer, you know, something for the ladies.
Then you got Adolf Hitler on the keyboards.
It is a little strange.
Why has that bloke got a Hitler mustache?
That documentary is directed by Edgar Wright, and when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this past weekend, my colleague John Horn caught up with him.
Edgar, great to talk to you again. Before we talk about the movie, I want to ask you about your personal connection to Sparks. How far back does it go, and what does the band mean to you personally?
Well, I think in a way they were a bit of an ongoing riddle for me for a large portion of my life. I saw them first on TV when I was 5 years old. So I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I liked music, but like, I'm not sure at 5 years old you would say, hey, I'm a music fan. But I would watch Top of the Pops every week, which was the big music show in the UK that, you know, I think like a third of the country were watching it when it was on, when there used to be three channels. So I remember Sparks on Top of the Pops because they really stood out from the other acts. Because like, if you had another act that seemed like desperate to be liked, like ABBA, who were all smiles and like dancing and kind of like grinning their way through the performance. And Sparks are sort of a different proposition, slightly intimidating, especially Ron Mayall like staring down the camera at you. And I know for a lot of people, and the documentary proves this, is that the image of Sparks on TV at that time was something that really stuck with people and, you know, influenced a lot of artists. But I just thought, like, who are these guys on the TV who are, like, sort of beguiling and ever so slightly intimidating as well?
Frequently asked questions about Sparks. Who are Sparks?
We are Sparks.
What are Sparks?
Sparks are a band.
Are you a real band?
Next question.
Are you an English band?
We are not an English band.
Dude. What do you play?
I'm the singer.
I'm not the singer.
Are you identical twins?
We are not identical twins.
How many Sparks albums are there?
There are 25 Sparks albums.
How many Sparks albums will there be?
With advances in medical technology, hopefully there will be 200 to 300 more Sparks albums.
You have always made narrative films. This is your first documentary. And first of all, I have to thank your editor, who must have made 10,000 cuts. I have no idea how many edits are in this film. It's mind-boggling. But when you are working in a documentary field and you are a visual storyteller and you have archival footage, at what point do you realize that you have to find out other ways to tell the story visually, using animation, using recreations, whatever it is? And how much of that was a creative challenge for you?
It wasn't a creative challenge as much as it was a gift. I mean, they had done a animated music video for their, not their last album, but the one prior to that. And they're obviously very visual. So animation seemed like a fun thing to do for interludes. And obviously, there are some bits where there are no photos and there is no footage. There's a great anecdote about Russell Mayall injuring himself during an early gig by throwing like a fairground mallet up in the air and it splitting his head open. Now, obviously, there's no footage of that. So it's like that's an obvious kind of place for some animation. So that was really fun. I mean, you know, like we spent, you know, most of the lockdown kind of doing the final edit, actually. And obviously we got like, you know, 70 years worth of archive. And then also I interviewed 80 people for the documentary. We had this footage of a 1975 concert where there are a lot of young female stage invaders like clambering onto the stage and like pulling Russell Mayall down onto the floor or latching onto Ron. And, you know, we have an interview with Ron and Russell. We also, Tony Visconti, who mixed that concert, is also one of the interviewees. Nick Hayward, who's in the band Haircut 100, happened to be in the audience. And then through social media, we put the word out as soon as it was announced that we were doing it. I put the word out and so did Spark, saying, hey, we're making this documentary. If you have any footage or photos or even a story, contact this email. So we got a ton of stuff through that, things that Ron and Russell had never seen. Things that like the sons of TV directors in Germany says, oh, my dad has this 35 mil can from a Sparks thing he shot, hasn't been seen in like, you know, 50 years. Also, one of the women, now in her late 50s, who was the stage invader, got in touch wrote this amazing kind of like email about her story. And I said to my producer, George Henkin, I said, we should get her to tell that story on camera, which we did. And so you now you've got this amazing thing. And you
well,
also...
and she's in the footage. I mean, she's like 15 years old and she goes up and I think she hugs Ron as he's playing piano.
And then the roadie that pulls her off is Richard Coble, who happens to be one of the biggest tour managers in the world because he's the Rolling Stones tour manager now. That was his first ever gig as a roadie for Sparks. So then to put together this kind of like multi POV like sort of narrative on just one stage invasion one night, that was just like a gift, an absolute gift.
It's John Horn for Take Two. I'm here with filmmaker Edgar Wright. His documentary about the band Sparks just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. So the Sparks brothers are from Los Angeles. I mean, they grew up in the Palisades, but they were really popular in Europe, especially in the UK. So how would you define their relationship to LA and how that might have influenced their sound?
You wouldn't think that Sparks were like kind of like surf bums, but in fact, they were like in Pacific Palisades, lying on the beach surfing all day and listening to kind of like sort of pop music like all day. And they said that was extremely formative. I mean, the thing that's funny to me, and one of the things that I hope this documentary does, is that I feel like Sparks like deserve to be Los Angeles rock royalty. And the only thing that's been holding them back is people think that they're not from California, or they're like dumbfounded when they find out they are. I mean, even like when I first got in contact with them, it's a funny story because, you know, Sparks in my head were sort of these enigmatic geniuses that like they were like the J.D. Salingers of rock. It's like you don't hang out with Sparks for real. Like, I'm not even sure they're on planet Earth. But the first time I ever got in contact with them, I was in Los Angeles myself writing Baby Driver, in fact. And I was in the office and I was playing my friend tons and tons of Sparks. We were on a bit of a Sparks marathon. Sort of the reason I made the documentary is so I wouldn't have to explain to my friends anymore how much I love Sparks. I could just have this film instead. And anyway, I thought, I wonder if Sparks are on Twitter. So I looked at Twitter and I didn't follow Sparks. I found their account and it said, Sparks follows you. So I was like, oh my God. So I sent them a direct message and Russell responded immediately. And I was like, oh, most bands have like a PR person that handles their account. He goes, not us. So it's like, and then he's like, where are you? I said, I'm in Los Angeles. Like, we're in Los Angeles too. And it's at that moment, the world becomes much smaller. It's like, wait, these guys only are a 20-minute drive away from me right now. So within 24 hours, I was having breakfast with them in Beverly Hills.
Let me ask this last question. You love to use song cues in your films. I don't know, because I didn't go look. Have you ever used a Sparks song in any of your films?
No, and I'll tell you why. I tried to once. I tried to use a Sparks song, This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, probably their most famous song, in Hot Fuzz. But here's the thing I discovered, and this is why I think Sparks are not on many soundtracks. Sparks cannot be audio wallpaper. Like, the songs are sort of too epic and the lyrics are sort of too evocative. They're not easy songs to just have on in the background. So I found when I put it on this scene, it worked pretty well for a bit. But at a certain point, especially as a fan, I found myself listening to the song and not paying attention to what was going on in the scene. So if Sparks haven't been in my films, it's because Sparks cannot easily be ignored. Sparks are not background music.
That was filmmaker Edgar Wright with KPCC's John Horn talking about his documentary about the band Sparks. No release date is planned. Take Two's release date is every day at 2 o'clock. And if you miss that release time and date, 2 o'clock, Monday through Friday. You can always find us wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on Twitter, at Take 2. That's at Take 2. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. And that's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2 is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.